today we're going to look at some of the lessons that people can learn from the military that's applicable in their personal lives, also in their civilian work experience. And in the military, you're always looking at lessons learned, lessons identified, lessons ignored. But hopefully with the really good ones and the important ones, if you document them and think about them right, the effort and the sacrifice that people made in order for those lessons to be identified and to be looked at can be turned into something positive. And that's what we're going to focus on today, because there was something from the experience of the American prisoners of war in the Hanoi Hilton during the Vietnam War that resulted in, as a cohort, when you look at them, they've all been very successful in their subsequent careers, which is just as varied as you expect from any group to be. And we're going to spend the hour discussing that and more with Peter Fretwell and Taylor Baldwin Killen, authors of the book Lessons from the Hanoi Hilton, Six Characteristics of High Performance Teams. Peter, is the general manager of the Classical Network. And Taylor, who we had on before for a little bit, she was very shy, but now we've got her for the full hour. She's a management consultant with a large strategy and consulting firm in Washington, D.C., and a former naval officer. She's been down the book route before, and she's written or co-authored three prior books, including Open Doors, Vietnam POWs 30 Years Later, and The U.S. Navy and Military Careers, A Walk in the Yard, a self-guided walking tour of the U.S. Naval Academy. Pete and Taylor, welcome to MidRats.
Thanks for having us.
Well, Taylor, being that we've had you on before, we'll give you the deference of throwing the first question your way, and then Pete can go ahead and roll in when you're done. And just as kind of a scene setter, and I'd want to recommend the listeners, if you're over at the show page, there's a link to the book. You can go ahead and click over to that and, you know, read the reviews, get an overview of the book. It's a very digestible, just a little bit more than 125 pages. It's a great rainy day afternoon book. It's not a big tome that's going to weigh down your backpack, so to speak. But, you know, looking at the book and looking at the title, it's interesting, especially for the younger generations, that there have always been prisoners of war in all wars. But there was something about the experience after the Vietnam War and the Vietnam POWs that was a lot different than what we had seen in other wars, World War II, Korea, and others. What was it that drew the two of y'all to that experience of the Vietnam POWs and to try to boil down something in lessons that apply outside of the lifelines of the military into everyday life?
Well, thanks, Sal and Eagle One, for having us on. You're right. This group of POWs is unique. When you compare them to other groups of POWs, as well as when you compare them to other groups of combat-tested veterans. They were and still are the longest-held group of POWs in our nation's history. There's no other group that has ever been held as long. Their average, well, the longest was held, you know, just shy of 9 years. And you mentioned the fact that they were extremely successful when they came home. There are, I think, of the 700 or so who returned from Vietnam, 24 of them attained general or flag officer rank. We have a presidential candidate. Most people are familiar with John McCain. We had a vice presidential candidate, Admiral Stockdale. We've had numerous senators. I mean, U.S. senators, U.S. congressmen, state senators, state representatives, political appointees, business leaders, doctors, lawyers, veterinarians, ministers, authors, you name it. But they were also highly successful when they were in captivity, and they were united in their resistance against their captors. They remained extremely unified. And when you look at this group of POWs and you compare them to similar demographic groups of POWs from other wars, you did not find the same division and individual aggression that you found in other wars. And they have one of the lowest rates of PTSD of any group of combat veterans I have ever researched. Their lifetime average is 4%. And I'm sure most of you are pretty familiar with the statistics from Vietnam and even the veterans who recently returned from Iraq and Afghanistan. Their average is more in the double digits. So Pete and I were just extremely attracted to this group of men because we really wanted to understand why they were so successful in captivity and in their subsequent careers and life, and how they did it.
When I think of why we chose this group, I flash back to a moment in Virginia Beach when we were sitting in George Coker's living room, and he said, "You've got to understand, this was a bell curve like any other organization. There were 11 at the high end." He was referring to what's known as the Alcatraz Gang, James Stockdale and 10 of his closest allies who the North Vietnamese considered to be troublemakers. And as Stockdale said, one man's troublemaker is another man's hero. He said, George Coker told us, at the other end of the bell curve, there were 11 men there. And basically what he meant, 11 people who were either acting traitorously or capable of it. They were very close to the line. What Coker said next will never leave me. He said, over the course of time, we got all but two of those 11 onto the bell curve. That speaks volumes about the type of organization it was. They not only went after their mission, they went after those who were at the low end of the bell curve to pull them into the mission. And they brought all but two of them onto the bell curve, doing what they could to achieve the mission. That's remarkable.
Well, I think you hit on a key point, which is that these guys had a mission. I mean, let's talk about that a little bit. Most of these guys are aviators. They get shot down, they get captured, and they get put into prison camps. And how do they get this mission? How do they get set up into the position where they were going through this process of being successful?
You want to take that one?
I think part of it you answered yourself, Eagle One, in the sense that they were military men, and they knew what their job was. They had the military code of conduct. What they really looked for was someone to tell them, how do we do that? What does that look like? And that's what James Stockdale stepped up to. There were four other people in the Hanoi Hilton over time who had higher rank than him, but he was the one with the courage, with the, if you will, love to step up and guide his men regardless of what it meant for his future and well-being. And he basically said, you are your brother's keeper. Here's our mission. Our mission is return with honor. And then he started laying out the real basic ways that you do that. And he kept it simple. He kept it clear. He left it as much of it up to the individual as he could. Senior ranking officers formed in each cell as they were able to commingle later on in the captivity. He just understood as a leader what was necessary in that particular environment to beat the North Vietnamese at this war of wills.
I might add that he took a lot of chances and a lot of risks in his leadership. He took the code of conduct, and he took it upon himself to adapt that code of conduct in captivity. Basically, put out an edict and said to the rest of the POWs, look, you can try to adhere to the letter of the law, to the exact standard and edict of the code of conduct, but it's probably not very realistic to think that any of us can live up to that standard and stay alive. And quite honestly, it's not worth our lives. We don't have any important intelligence information after about 3 days of captivity. So he adapted the code of conduct. And he said, resist to the best of your ability. Resist as much as you can. But when you've reached your breaking point and you have to give in, don't worry about it. we all have done that. He used the term, he said, there are no virgins in here. But what he did say to them is, what you must, if you fall down, if you fail, you must get back up again. And you must resist again when they take you back into the interrogation session. So what he did is essentially he gave them the permission to fail without being a failure. And it was brilliant. It enabled them to work towards the mission, but it also gave them the freedom to perform to the best of their ability, and it also gave them the freedom to fail if they had to.
Pete Taylor kind of set up my next question perfectly, and I'll go ahead and roll it to you. As I read the book, there was a recurring character who managed to weave himself back through and, you know, very closely tied to Stockdale. But for the listener, if you could take a minute and tell us, who is Epictetus and what was his role in the success of the POWs there in the Hanella Hilton?
That's a great question, Commander. Epictetus was a Stoic philosopher from ancient Greece, and he was, if you will, the seer for Commander Stockdale. He had studied Epictetus when he was doing graduate work at Stanford, and one of his professors there gave him Epictetus's probably seminal work, and he really, for the most part, committed it to his life and his life to it. And as he was parachuting down over North Vietnam after being shot down, he understood clearly that he was going into what he called the world of Epictetus. And he drew from that his training in the classics and his training in the humanities, what matters in life, what am I living for, what is life about. He drew on that as the baseline for the decisions he made in guiding these men. And he later in life looked back and said it was the classics and the humanities that got us through. That didn't always stand him in good stead. He had a showdown with Hyman Rickover over that very issue when Stockdale was the president of the Naval War College, because Rickover, of course, wanted to teach engineering, science, and technology, and Stockdale was committed to the fact that in war, men have to have baseline values, things that are worth living for and worth dying for. And he, from Epictetus, he gathered that in for himself and eventually for the whole camp.
One of the things that struck me when I was reading the book was I was comparing what these guys were doing with the world, some of the World War II prisoners in the German prison camps. Of course, I mean, there are many differences, but if you took the Great Escape aviators who were in a camp, they too kind of lived through this never give up, and they suffered a number of failures. Did you look at a comparison like that at all, or was this did you think this was a unique group of people?
We did actually look. I didn't look at the Great Escape example, but I looked at the King Rat example, which, if you're familiar with the book or the movie, was based on a POW camp in Japan. And it was an example of where one rogue prisoner basically established himself as not the inspirational leader, but the dictatorial leader, one who took all kinds of favors and extra benefits for himself at the expense of his other prisoners. He put himself first, and he lived much differently than the rest of the prisoners. And his leadership was toxic, it was divisive, and it was corrosive. And so we looked at that example as a comparison to how the leadership and the organizational culture that leadership engenders can really make a difference in an environment like this.
I think it's a great question, and I think undoubtedly when you look at the Holocaust, when you look at other wars and POWs, you will always find people who acted honorably. You will also find in most instances a number of people who act, I guess for lack of a better term, dishonorably. They act in their own selfish interest. They act out what John Neumann called the prisoner's dilemma. I will turn on you and sell you down the river for my own survival. The thing that makes the POWs and the Hanoi Hilton really exceptional is they chose to stay in place. They actually decided collectively that escape was not the best route for bringing everybody home safely. They learned that early on with a couple of bad escape attempts and bad results. And they decided that staying there and becoming active participants in the war behind the prison walls was the best option for getting everybody home safely and intact. That is unique, and that is exceptional that they would commit themselves to it. Stockdale actually sent men into torture later on so that they could gather intelligence about where the enemy was and what they were thinking. That also is a bit exceptional. Probably not on parallel, but still remarkable over 7 years, 7.5 years.
You have to remember what Stockdale said to his organization in captivity. He said, "You are still in the war. You may feel like you're sidelined, but you are still in the war. You are not flying bombing missions over North Vietnam anymore, but you are still in the war. You are fighting a different battle. You're fighting the battle of propaganda." But he made it clear that what they were doing there was just as important. And, of course, we know that it was. They were a huge, huge propaganda tool and bargaining tool for the Vietnam War.
Yeah, you know, there's a and Taylor, I'll roll this at you, is this question to start with. You know, there's that old cliche phrase that, you know, character is not built, it's demonstrated. But when you look at the results of leadership under just exceptional circumstances, both in the performance of the leadership and the challenges they faced, and, you know, we were talking about the bell curve before. At one point of the book, you talk about there is an ability based upon if you have the right leaders that you can, a bell curve is always going to exist, but you can shift that bell curve one way or another based upon who is anchoring it at the leadership end, at the right side of the end. I thought that was interesting. But what does their experience show us about the ability of leadership under adverse circumstances of taking character and maybe not building it, but refining it, refining a person's character, shaping a person's character in order to move that general direction and the behavior of that character to where you want it, vice where it might be negative? Taylor?
I'm thinking. Pete, I'm wondering.
I'm sorry, that's a complicated question. Take all your time.
I'm trying to think of an example. You know, there are a number of examples where, and George Coker is a perfect, he was one of the youngest POWs, and, you know, he really viewed himself, I think they called him, either called him the youngster, or they had a nickname for him, I can't remember exactly what it is, but I think they took it upon themselves to really mentor him. And then there's another example of a POW, Doug Hegdahl. He was one of the few enlisted in the Hanoi Hilton. For those of you who are familiar with the prison population in the Hanoi Hilton, they were mostly aviators who were shot down while performing bombing missions over North Vietnam. So they were all aviators, or overwhelmingly, the overwhelming majority were all aviators, and they were all officers. Hegdahl was actually blown off the deck of a ship into the Tonkin Gulf during a firing exercise on his ship, and was captured by Vietnamese and taken north to the Hanoi Hilton. So he was much, much younger than these guys, but he had an uncanny memory. He had a photographic memory, and he memorized several hundred names of POWs by putting it into a ditty. I think he did it to the tune of Old MacDonald Had a Farm. And the POWs were instrumental in building up his self-confidence and his ability to memorize even more. And they actually sent him home early because he had so much valuable information. His real mentor, in addition to Stockdale, was Dick Stratton, who really was his daily coach and almost like an older brother to him. Do you have any other examples, Pete?
Well, the question goes to the heart of my passion about this book, and I'm not sure you want my 10-minute answer. I'll try and trim it to 8. You touch on something there that is just for me. It is the most intriguing and perplexing and difficult and challenging part of this whole book is how is it that a great leader can get a group of people in life and death circumstances to rise up and put themselves on the line, even as she or he is putting themselves on the line, and to get most of them to follow that example, even at risk of their own well-being. And that is, of course, exactly what James Stockdale and Robbie Reisner and Jeremiah Denton did. Those are the three true de facto leaders of that camp. And Stockdale, one thing that just comes to mind immediately is Congressman Sam Johnson talked about the fact that he once saw Stockdale come out of solitary and torture. He said he was just a shadow of the man that he knew. He was stooped, he was disheveled, his head was down, he was shuffling. And he said over the next few weeks, I slowly saw his shoulders come back, his head came back up, and our commander was back after 2 weeks. George Coker described much the same thing for Reisner, Denton, and Stockdale. And then he said as soon as they were knocked down, they would start getting back up. It might take them a day. It might take them a week. And in some cases, if it was particularly brutal, it might take them a month. But what he said next, again, is one of those things that will stick with me as long as I live. Coker said, and then they would turn right around and go back in. They turn right around and march back through the gates of hell for their men. And when you see that enough over 7.5 years, Stockdale tortured 15 times, I think at some level, if you have any honor, any integrity in yourself at all, any self-esteem left, you reach down in your socks and you say, I got to pull myself up. Paul Galani said, there was no way I was going to let this old duffer who was twice his age, I think Galani was 23, 24, and Stockdale was in his mid-40s, said there was no way I was going to let this old duffer outperform me. There's something there that is both challenging and humbling and inspiring when men will put themselves on the line for the people they lead. And when you see it, I think in most cases, particularly among military people, for whom honor and duty is a very primal thing, they respond.
Well, that raises an interesting question, which you touch on in your book, which is the nature or nurture. I mean, these similar training programs had very common backgrounds in some ways, and yet divergent backgrounds in others. And I think you tie that in very nicely, and that the divergence of the background actually aided some of them. Could you kind of discuss the nature nurture argument a little bit about how these guys got their leadership rolling?
Taylor,
sure. I can talk a little bit about both actually. A lot of people don't realize that this group of men were much older than your average Vietnam veteran, and probably much older than other POW populations from other wars. Their average age was 34, and there were many of the POWs who were in their late 30s and early 40s, and that's when they were shot down at the beginning of their incarceration. So with an older population like that, of course, comes more maturity, right? Just more life perspective. So that really, really assisted them in weathering the experience. Secondly, the Mitchell Center for POW Studies in Pensacola, Florida, if your listeners aren't familiar with it, is a Navy center that has been studying the long-term physical and mental health of the POWs for the last 40 years. It's a voluntary program. The POWs are invited to come down along with their spouses for a full physical, both their physical health and their mental health. And most of them participate because it's great health care. And it's complimentary to them. And so they have one of the longest longitudinal studies of any group of POWs. Probably a very combat-tested group of veterans as well. And they have done some tests on their personalities, and they have come away with some interesting results. And one is that these men are, a majority of them, are naturally optimistic. They also have determined that they are both highly ambitious and highly affiliative. And usually in most populations, you find those inversely correlated. But this group of men are both highly ambitious and highly team-oriented. So you take those types of DNA that they bring to the table, where they're both incredibly aggressive and ambitious, but they're very team-oriented, and they're naturally optimistic, meaning they look at traumatic events as temporary, local, and external. And that just brings a mindset to the experience that's much different from pessimists. So that's the natural DNA that they brought to the table. You combine that with the fact that they were highly educated. Most of them were college educated and some had master's degrees. They were highly trained by the military, right? They had all been through aviation training. A lot of them had been through SEER training. And for those of your listeners who don't know what that is, that's the POW training that they send military aviators, special operations, and others through. So they were probably more prepared for the POW experience than your average foot soldier would be. So that's some of the nature and the nurture they brought to the table. And then you combine that, of course, with all of the leadership that they received there. And you had just the makings of, you know, a very successful experience. Is there anything you want to add?
Yeah, I think it's important to point out that when you talk about optimism, one thing that the Mitchell Center emphasized is this is a teachable trait. If you're willing to learn, people who are optimistic can teach you, even if you are genetically or from your background a bit of a pessimist, they can teach you how to reframe things and be optimistic. And when you talk about affiliative and ambitious, that's a choice. That's a personal responsibility issue. If you're a highly competitive type A personality, you can sublimate that. You can learn to be a team player if you choose to, if you will take the personal responsibility to balance out those two things in your own personality and in your own DNA. That's where the nurture and nature come together. It isn't all of one or all of the other. You have personal responsibility and the ability to learn in there with your genetic advantages or disadvantages.
And Pete, I want to go ahead and throw the next question to you. And for those that are joining the show late, BJ, I'm talking to you. Our guest for the full hour to discuss their new book, Lessons from the Hanoi Hilton, Six Characteristics of High-Performance Teams, are Peter Fretwell and Taylor Baldwin Killen. And what I wanted to ask is, we've gotten halfway through the show, and we haven't even asked for you to outline the subtitle of the book, The Six Characteristics of High-Performance Teams, that y'all managed to boil down looking at the experience of the group of Vietnam POWs. And kind of how I'd want to engage that is, you know, Pete, if you could go ahead and outline what those six characteristics that y'all address in the course of the book, but for you personally, and then, you know, Taylor, you as well, which of those six characteristics you found the most impactful to you personally as you were writing the book?
Wow. Okay. Number one, the mission leads. This is not a leader-centric organization. It's mission-centric. James Stockdale, a number of times, believed and told other POWs he probably wasn't going to make it home, and yet he was supremely confident they could make it home because they were a mission-centric organization, not leader-centric. Number two, you're your brother's keeper. You are responsible for protecting the guy in the cell next to you while still challenging him to grow and learn. Number three of the six characteristics, think big and basically. Keep the rules of the road to a minimum. Make sure they're clear. Focus on the mission. Let individuals exercise as much individual personal judgment as they can in the situation. Number four was one that Charlie Zuhofsky outlined for us. Don't piss off the turnkey. Make sure that you stress effectiveness and efficiency. Don't waste energy and time on things that do not directly lead you toward your mission and achieving it. Number five is kind of a big umbrella thing we call keeping the faith. But what we mean by that is, sustainable high-performance cultures have rational beliefs and the optimism that Taylor talked about, that very definable belief system of three things. The members of a high-performance team that are keeping the faith are willing to face their fears, take risks. They view failure and setbacks as something that is temporary, local, external. It's not permanent. It's not pervasive. It's not personal. They use failure, which they're going to do regularly because they're pushing the envelope. They use it as a learning mechanism. And number six, the power of we. The sustainable high-performance culture finds personal and organizational meaning in what they're trying to achieve, why the mission matters, and in their commonly embraced values that connect them, how they are connected. They don't focus on what's different about them. They focus on what they share in common. The one that's probably most impactful to me, I would say, varies from day to day and situation to situation, but the one that probably best encompasses why I believe they succeeded is the second one: you are your brother's keeper. If you will continually protect the other guy's back while challenging him to be everything he can be on the team, to be going the same direction as everybody else, you're going to have an organization that's dynamic and is incredibly, incredibly effective.
Yeah, I thought that was a very important point. I also thought the fact that the mission statement was simple and yet in the few words, but very complex in the way you could interpret the mission statement, because it allowed for a lot of development in and of itself. Did you think that was important, or am I being simplistic here?
Not at all. Not at all. I think one of the Stockdale tells about a test pilot, an old test pilot, and there aren't necessarily a lot of those, he told him, you know, don't get caught up in all of the folderol about how difficult it is to fly. He said, you need two things. You need fire, and what was the other one, Taylor? Fuel to fly. And he said, always think big and basically. And Stockdale did that. He said, this is where we're headed. There's the goal line. Meet me there. Do what you can do. Do it to the best of your ability. Understand when you fail that you can learn something from it. No, I think you're absolutely right. That latitude to understand that when you're in the torture room, you're the only one in there, and you have to live with yourself, do what you can do, come out and tell us what you did so that it protects the next guy going in.
Yeah, Taylor, I probably cut you off on your answer too, but part of that, when you talk about the optimism, I thought return and the return with honor really did indicate a degree of optimism that was kind of surprising for guys who didn't have any idea how long they'd be in a prison camp.
Yeah, they didn't lose sight of the fact that they knew they were going to be there for a long time. There were no Pollyannas in there who said, oh, we're going to be, you know, a couple weeks and we'll be home. They knew they were going to be there a long time, but they also never lost sight of the fact and never lost hope that they were eventually going to get home. And actually, when I asked in my research for my previous book about the POWs Open Doors, when I asked them about the guys who did die in captivity, and there were several of them, I said, how would you characterize them? He said, they were the ones who lost hope. You know, he said, the degree of their injuries really made no difference. And the degree to which they were tortured really made no difference. The determining factor as to whether or not they survived, both physically and mentally, was their ability to maintain hope, which I thought was pretty telling.
Eagle One?
I think I stole your last question, so it's up to you, Sal.
Okay, well, you know me, I always have five times more questions than I ever have time to ask. And Taylor, let me roll this to you, because when I was looking at the six aspects and I was reading them, you know, having been a civilian for 4 years now, one of the things that really hit to me when you're looking at, you know, how you can roll this into your civilian life, especially professionally, if you're in a leadership or if you're in an organization where you have people working with you and for you that interact at different levels in the supply chain, whether you're talking about a warehouse guy, a regional manager, or just the poor schmo that has to call you and deliver you the bad news. And that was, you know, don't piss off the turnkey. If you could take a while and talk about where that comes from and how you see the tie-in for people in their personal and professional life. It's very, very drastic example for the POWs that they pissed off the turnkey. But it is a very good fundamental characteristic, especially when concerning managing your networks and your contacts or just being a decent human being.
Right. Well, Charlie Duhosky, who's one of the POWs we interviewed, and he is now a retired partner from Booz Allen Hamilton, my employer. He actually used that term in a story, and we thought it was so symbolic that we adopted it for this characteristic. But he said that one of the major mistakes people would, some of the POWs would do, was that they would do something to annoy or anger or piss off the low-level guard who was just responsible for bringing them their food. And he said, if you pissed off the turnkey just by doing something or saying something stupid and something inconsequential, you may not get your meal that night. You know, as bad as the meals were, they still wanted their meals. And he said, you know, you really needed to reserve your efforts and your energy for something that matters. In other words, pick your battles, right? And I think, you know, those of us who work in the private sector and, you know, in the military and in the government as well, probably spend too much time and too much effort and too much energy, quite honestly, on inconsequential things. Which is why characteristic number one is really the one that has the most impact on me. I find that I can get bogged down at work on, you know, just the mundane, it might be the most laborious or tedious, but the mundane activities and tasks that aren't necessarily driving us forward and getting us where we want to go. And if you really focus on the mission, it will always drive not only your behavior, but it'll drive your priorities as well.
Commander, I think if I heard your question correctly, I think too there is that underlying relational component to that too. It is so easy to try and choose my verb here carefully to do something deprecating downhill, somebody lesser power, lesser status than you in an organization, a vendor, a supplier, a clerk, a secretary, an executive assistant. It's so easy to take your frustrations out on them when somebody above you has taken out their frustration on you. And this does call you to stop doing that because it is counter to the mission. It's counter to being your brother's keeper. It is not productive. It does not enhance effectiveness or efficiency. Quite the contrary, it disrupts morale. It harms relationship. So there is definitely that relational component to this statement as well.
Yeah, I was reading something, I think, in Forbes magazine today, and they were talking about they're talking about a guest who left his room only to find when he had to go back, and there was somebody there fixing his lock on his door because it didn't it's about the Four Seasons. It didn't make the Four Seasons sound. There's some distinctive noise they wanted to make when a guest room's locked. But this went through the fact that these people were in power. The maid had noticed it, or whoever was cleaning the room had noticed it, and had called up the management and said, we need to get somebody here to fix this lock. And it was the little details like that struck me as kind of being germane to what you all were writing about, that they had empowered these people at the lower levels to take care of business. And they knew what the mission was. I mean, is this the kind of thing that we're looking at as an application of your book in the real world, or am I headed off on another tangent here?
No, I think you're right on target. I think that that happens in a highly effective, highly efficient, high-performance culture is when people know what the big picture is, when they're empowered and given both the responsibility and the authority, and then they're held accountable for getting to the finish line. Most people will do that.
Taylor?
The key term is empowered. When the lowest level, when every single person in the organization embraces the mission and is empowered to take individual action to advance the mission, then you've established and permeated a high performance culture, whether it's the Four Seasons, the Ritz-Carlton.
That ties into a question. Oh, are you there, Taylor? Are you breaking up?
No, I'm finished. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I want to go ahead and I'll throw this. I think I've put my last question to you, Taylor, so I'll roll this over to Pete to kick off. I'm going to kind of fold in one of the questions brought up by Mary in the chat room with something that you just mentioned. You're talking about the Four Seasons. As you're going through this book, and if you look at the six characteristics and thinking of the types of leaders in the civilian sector, whether it's business or politics, were there a few people that are in the civilian sector who really exemplify those type of six characteristics that are in business right now that other people can look to and go, yeah, that's kind of the person I'm talking about? Pete?
You want me to answer that?
Yes, please.
Okay. No. That's the short answer.
They should read your book, then.
I think the reality is this. We have a shortage of this type of leader in America today, not just in business, not just in nonprofits. I would say even in the U.S. military, these are the exceptions, not the rule. It was a sports psychologist who really put us on to some of this. That was Nate Zinsser up at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. And I personally believe that these principles are so broad that they cover virtually every spectrum from a POW camp halfway around the world through sports. And when you think about it on the bell curve of what matters in life, there aren't many things further apart on the bell curve than sports and life and death in a POW camp. They really do lie at the opposite ends of what matters in life. And Nate Zinsser felt firmly that these principles cover, and I agree with him. And what we need is people with the courage of a James Stockdale to step up, put aside their own self-interest, and to lead for the interest of the group and for the mission. And that is so rare that while I don't want to say there are not leaders in any area of life who model this, they're few and far between.
Well, I think there are a few out there that come to mind for me. One is a leader and one is a company. I think Fred Smith from FedEx is a charismatic leader who is, you know, not only had the vision for his company. I believe FedEx was a thesis or a term paper for him in graduate school, and he was the last, his professor, as I understand it, laughed at him when he said, I want to build a company that gets packages and deliveries overnight, and you know the mission is very, very clear. And even if Fred Smith stepped down from the company, it is very, very clear exactly what their mission is. They are a very, very mission-oriented organization. They get the packages there overnight. And the other company that I would mention, not necessarily for its leadership, but for its the culture that has outlasted many leaders, is USAA. I think they are singularly focused on a particular type of customer, and that is their mission, serving that customer. And I think I think they exhibit a number of these different characteristics. I haven't worked at either one of these organizations, but from my reading about them, both of them seem to exhibit some of these characteristics.
It's a challenging question in that I believe that when Jim Collins wrote about the level 5 leader in Good to Great, I personally believe he had James Stockdale in mind because they were at that point well acquainted at Stanford. He wrote about the Stockdale paradox in the same book. And Collins points out there aren't many level 5 leaders. They don't tend to be charismatic leaders. They tend to be very mission-driven, very humble, which describes James Stockdale to a T. I can't disagree with Taylor that there are companies that show a number of these characteristics, but in terms of actual leaders who consistently model at a high level, that level 5 leadership, very, very few of them. And then at this point, I'd have to say in politics, you don't need more than one hand to count, maybe not even most of the hand.
Yeah, the concept of servant leader, I think, has been tossed around in your book and in other places, but that did strike me as a key to some of the success of the leadership of these guys in the Hanoi Hilton. The other thing that I thought was really impressive was communication, not only the modeling you described, but the fact that they were able to, using the most primitive means possible, communicate up and down their chain of command. Their ideas. Can you discuss how important that is to them?
Taylor?
Sure. The communications that they established was both rudimentary in some cases and highly sophisticated in others. For those in your audience who weren't familiar with the TAP code, it was a modified Morse code that they taught each other and used to tap messages to each other across prison walls. More often than not, they tapped it, but sometimes if they were unable to tap it, they would cough it to each other. Or if they were assigned the task of sweeping outside in the courtyard, they would sweep the code. And this communication system was vital. It was the way that they spread the leadership philosophy of Stockdale. It was the way that they engendered and communicated the organizational mission and permeated this mission-centric culture throughout the prison camp and across several other prison camps. Without that communication system and the sustainment of that communication system, the organization probably would not have remained intact.